Welcome to the Herd Quitter Podcast. I'm your host, Jared Lumen. On this show, we talk to farmers and ranchers who aren't afraid to think for themselves and do things a little bit differently. We hope these guests will challenge you to look at your farms and ranches in a new way and result in a more profitable and enjoyable business for you and your family. Hey there, and welcome back to the Herd Quitter Podcast. I'm really excited for today's episode with Aaron Helmick. He is a farmer out in West Virginia who shares an awesome story of his journey to getting into farming and ranching full-time. It's a pretty cool story, a lot to gain from his story, and especially if you're trying to do it yourself, get into it maybe without a family history or, you know, an inherited ranch or farm. He did it, so definitely worth listening to. Before we do that, neither of these things I'm going to mention here are paid ads, so I'd sure appreciate if you take a listen. I just wanted to mention two things before we got into today's show. And today, the first thing I wanted to mention is there are some pretty nasty wildfires going on down in Texas and in the panhandle of Texas. I'm just looking at the Texas A&M Forest Service fire information here, and it looks like there's still several fires that are active and not contained and having currently already burned well over 1 million acres, 1.25 million acres. And so, you know, I just wanted to bring that to your attention and ask that you might pray for those down there. And if it's something you might be interested in doing, maybe find a way to donate. There's several resources online, places you can donate financially. And I believe there are people setting up opportunities to donate things, whether that's hay or fencing supplies. You know, just getting through this fire here in the short term is just going to be the start for a lot of these ranchers. There's going to be months, if not years, of rebuilding. And so just keep them in your thoughts and prayers. That's one thing I wanted to mention. But then on a lighter note, I also really wanted to mention, well, I've mentioned a few times in the past that I work for the Sustainable Farming Association, and coming up here very shortly is our Midwest Soil Health Summit. We do this every year. I'm helping put that on and organize it. Again, this isn't a paid ad, but I wanted to share it because I think it's an awesome resource. We've got a great lineup of speakers. One of our headliners is Burke Teichert, who, if you haven't heard of him or read some of his articles or listened to him on the Working Cows podcast, he's been on there a few times. I'd really encourage you to do that. He's a ranch management expert. We've also got Dale Strickler coming, who's been on the podcast a few times. He's going to talk about using cover crops and planting and building a drought-resilient farm, and it's going to be really good. Then we've also got a bunch of local Minnesota farmers and cattlemen as well. So I'd encourage you to check it out. Our theme kind of for the whole event is managing for profit with the soil health principles. So the goal is, yeah, just to tie in how soil health principles can help farms and ranchers actually grow more profitable. So if that's something that you're interested in, well worth checking out. It's March 13th and 14th coming up here just in 10 days in Mankato, Minnesota. You can find more information about that at SFA. That stands for Sustainable Farming Association, sfa-mn.org. I'd love if you were able to come. I'll be there, and it should be a really good event, so check it out if you're able. But with that, we will dive into our conversation with Aaron. It's sure to be a good one, and I hope that you enjoy it. Thanks so much.
Aaron, thanks so much for joining me, and welcome to the Herd Quitter Podcast.
Good morning, Jared. It's a pleasure to be here, a privilege as well, and thank you for what you're doing.
Oh, absolutely. I just so appreciate you being willing to do it. I had a listener reach out, and it's some of my favorite things when listeners reach out and give me cool recommendations, because there's folks like you and others all over the country that are doing incredible things. And you may or may not think you're doing incredible things, but other people do. And I'll never hear of those people, and I'll never be able to share their story and learn from them if someone in your areas are not going to let me, if someone doesn't let me know. So I appreciate that that listener who shared your contact or shared your name, and I appreciate you for joining me. Thanks so much. And I guess how we'll maybe start it off today is to just learn a little bit about your history in agriculture. I'm not sure if you have a family history in ag, and if so, what did that look like? And if not, what got you into ag or got you interested in it?
Well, I will hit the comment you made there. Yeah, we don't feel like we're doing anything special other than we're trying to fail forward.
Yeah.
And then we do try to tell people very loudly and clearly our mistakes so they don't fall into the same things that we do. And we try to approach our topics and conversations that way. To be specific to your question, I am not from a farm. Well, I guess I would say it is. My parents did raise some livestock up to the time I was about three and a half years old. The only thing I can tell you I remember is my dad had an Alice Chalmers tractor and we had bottle lambs. I can't remember anything else about that. And then my dad took a town job, and he was kind of a sad story. It was my great granddad's place, and my parents were there to take care of them and then move into ownership. And the lesson there was they didn't have anything in writing. And so when great granddad passed away, again, I don't remember much of that, but that was the end of that deal. And but I always had a love for it. And I had a cousin, he's older than me. He will turn 70 this year, but they always pail milked a few cows and made some butter and cottage cheese and, you know, harvested their own meat and everything, big garden. And I spent all my summers there and every holiday I had in school because it was the closest relative I had to a farm and agriculture, and just loved to spend time there. And I found that my mother and I got along much better when I wasn't at home. So it was kind of a win-win.
So that was kind of your, I mean, what is that kind of what sparked your interest then? And what made you decide to have a little bit of interest and go into it full time as production agriculture? And, that's a lot of people are interested, but maybe they don't see it as a possibility for themselves to be actually be able to do it, or they don't know how, if there is a possibility. But
I have a odd personality, and I guess one of the things that when you tell me I can't do something, that just really, I mean, even I don't know who recommended you, but you know, you were just out here east doing a thing for the Virginia Forage Grasslands. Two of my friends that I met that are, you know, are participants in that, we became friends because they angered me. I was at a demonstration at their farm, and one of them said something. I'm like, you know, that just fired me up. And we've become very good friends. And another one on up the valley there, 2.5 hours from your first location, same thing. I was at a farm tour he did, and he said something, and oh man, it just inflamed me. And so I guess I'm more of an emotional person than I would care to be. But at the same time, those instances usually get me fired up. And it was basically, I was told all my life that you know, you can't do this. You're not going to be able to do this. And stubbornness, I don't know. I don't think it's pride, but more stubbornness that just doesn't seem like the right answer. It didn't seem like an organic, I've got to accept this answer.
Seems like that's actually pretty common. Like, I just did a had a conversation with Kit Farrow that I don't think I've released yet. But he talks all the time. He had his mind set on what was right, and he was stubborn, and that's what got him through it. And he's found a lot of success in that. And Will Harris, I don't know if he shared that in this one or past or what, but I think he's kind of said similar stuff about his success. And it takes a little bit of stubbornness to be successful in a business model that is, well, there's definitely opportunity for profit, but it takes the people who are going to be looking a little beyond that. But now that seems like a common trend, a common trait with folks that find success, especially first generation operators, because I mean that's very challenging. Well, I'd like to hear about how you did it, but I have people reach out to me all the time through this podcast. It's been a cool opportunity, and I wish I could share it with them. Experience like you have of actually doing it. I grew up on a family farm, so it's not the same, but people who want to get into agriculture and ask me how, and it's more directing them to stories like yours and folks that are doing this. And Drew Bruner, I just released a couple weeks ago, and there's a lot of people doing it. So maybe we jump into your story, I guess, when you decided you want to do it, and for whatever reason, whatever drive you had, you decided you were going to do it. How did you go about first getting into ag? Or into production agriculture, into farming. What were some of those first steps?
We grew up poor, and I don't remember wanting for anything. We were never hungry, nothing like that. I don't mean it like that. I mean, we were very blessed in terms of, you know, the global economy, but we didn't have nice things and that kind of thing. And I remember I'd gotten involved in a judging, livestock judging. It was dairy actually, and I just wanted to show calf, and my mom and dad told me, well, if you want it, you work for it. So I peddled produce in a little red wagon when I was 11 years old to get $120 to buy this first calf. and worked out an arrangement at the dairy 3 miles up the road where they would basically house the animal for so much a month. And then by the time I was 12, I got off the bus there. I was there till my parents would pick me up, which was usually 9:30 at night, and
Wow.
I didn't miss a holiday, Christmas, anything until I was 17, 18 years old and chose a little different career path. I was there every day.
Wow.
We also hustled, and my brother and I, we mowed grass in the neighborhood. We grew potatoes. We grew tobacco. We had honeybees. We did maple syrup. One of my favorite quotes was always, it's not enough to itch for something. You got to scratch for it. And that's pretty much how we went about it. The biggest issue, and we'll talk about this hopefully in a little bit, is I didn't have any business sense. I knew how to make money, but I didn't know what to do with it.
Well, and that is a good topic that I want to get into. But well, that's just interesting because I think that there's a lot of even farm kids that don't want to work that hard. And you, this wasn't even your farm. You didn't have an obligation, but you were dedicated. Yeah, it wasn't just a niche. Yeah, you were all about that, it sounds like. So,
I
man,
was,
that
yeah, I was not a popular kid in high school. I mean, I didn't go to prom, I didn't play sports, but I always make the joke that I was all-state milker my senior year, which is completely fabricated, but
Yeah.
yeah, but it's
Oh,
just
man.
it was a peaceful place for me to be and grow up. And
Yeah.
looking back, I'm really glad in some ways. I mean, there's things that I probably missed as being a kid. My wife tells our children that, your dad wasn't a kid. And he started working. And But my dad was sick, and we had to buy a lot of our clothes, and we bought a lot of our own groceries. And I remember getting my first W-2 when I was 13, and like, what is this? Why do I have a W-2? And I
Yeah.
remember when we got it because mom said, "You're on your own. You're going to be getting your clothes and your groceries from now on."
Wow.
That was just a different thing, but it also kept me out of trouble. I wasn't prone to trouble, but I have an imagination for being busy. And so if you're not busy, you'll get into trouble. So I appreciate that part of it.
Do you think, and this is maybe not a question you had planned on answering, but do you think that was, there's probably not a right or wrong either, but for lack of a better word, the right way to grow up? Do you raise your kids with similar expectations or similar, or how do you, what would you do differently if you could go back again, or would you?
I would probably communicate more, or understand. My parents were not very good at that. It was almost like it became an obligation. Dave Ramsey calls work character building. And so we try to structure that with our children in that way. We have four kids. They all have livestock. They all have a set of chores. Chores we do not pay them for. I mean, that's part of being in the family. If you come work on the farm like yesterday, we work steers all day long. That's an hourly rate. We pay you for that. We do not, we don't ask them to buy their own clothes or their own groceries. But if they want something extra, that comes out of their savings. In other words, we separate it by if you want something, that's on you. If you need something, that's on us. And so, I have a son that plays soccer. We take care of his needs there and get him to and fro. That's part of being a kid, and we're going to take care of that. Now, when he wants to buy a shotgun or something, that's on him, And he's got the money and the means to do it. And we've both offered, both of our oldest two have been taught the beginnings of sell buy. My daughter has ran with it. My son has not. He's a more conservative investor. There's nothing wrong with that. He still puts up a good return on his account. But my daughter, she 5X'd her account last year, not counting her inventory. When you add her inventory, she's almost 7.5 times. And she will run through the house now counting her livestock inventory in front of her brothers, I think just to make them angry. So I'm trying to do better and different, but at the same time, I want to say reverently, the only things my parents really gave me was a work ethic. And I do appreciate that.
Yeah. Well, it's the conversation of work, it's been on my mind here a little more lately. I'm listening to a sermon series about work and finding purpose in your work and stuff. And it talks about the work was not the result of sin. Sin made work more difficult, but work can be a benefit and can be a joy and can be a huge, purpose. It can give purpose to life, and so much good can come out of work. And so it's
It's cool that you that was instilled in you early and that you're finding a way to instill that in your children. I know as we raise a 2.5 year old and a 6 month old now, we're starting to figure out little early, we're very early yet, but yeah, it's going to be fun to figure out how we can instill that hopefully in them, because I agree that we've benefited a lot from that, my wife and I growing up on farms as well. It's one of the probably biggest advantages of growing up on a farm that we can give our children if done right.
I married well, way above what I should have. And one of my favorite quotes from my wife is she tells my oldest son all the time, if we've done our job, when you leave, your life will be easy. I'm not sure he appreciates that comment. And she doesn't mean it that forcefully, but she likes to tell him that all the time, just to
I
humble
like
him a
that.
little bit.
And someday he will probably appreciate that. Yeah, no, that's good. Cool. Okay. So you worked on this farm until you were 17, 18 years old. And then I think you mentioned you went off into a different career field, but yeah, tell me about that.
Doubt set in just a little bit. I'm not going to be able to, it was a mind thing. I'm not going to be able to farm like this, not the way I want to do it. So, I really entertained at that point vet school, and I'd went to work for a veterinarian to entertain that. And I loved that job, but again, it was in the wrong context and I didn't understand it till later. So it was a great learning experience. And at the same time, I was getting ready to enroll in college, and I was the first generation to go to college. And I remember working at the vet. Surgeries were, I loved them, and they were my favorite thing, especially large animal surgeries. And but it didn't resonate with me that you shouldn't be doing a surgery on a large animal. She should be fine. If she has a displaced abdomasum or calving difficulties, things of that nature, those were management events. And it started to stick with me that we were not solving a problem. It was very much like an accountant and an attorney. You were basically paying someone to find problems, and that just did not seem right. And then there was this little thing called organic chemistry, which was a nail in the coffin for me. So those things came together and then reinforced, like, I want to be more on the production side, preventative side, and that kind of thing. So that was a great transition.
Oh, that's funny. My wife's sister gave us a bunch of science books. She's a doctor, went through a lot of science classes for that are kids' books. And it's like the quantum physics or organic chemistry for baby. And at the end of the book, it always says, now you're a quantum physicist or now you're an organic chemist. And it's funny, every time I read that, I'm like, man, it seemed a lot harder back in college for some reason. So yeah, I guess my son is smarter than I am now, but so that was a quick shift. And when you decided then to move out of the vet school program, wasn't that the direction you went? Where did you go from there?
Finished my degree in agricultural education. Animal science was not a marketable degree, and the school I went to, Ag Ed, was the number one marketable program, as well as it was one of the more diverse. And I knew what I was going to do. So at that point, it become let's get the degree and move on here. And then I started basically during my last 2 years of college. I also milked and at the university, and I also had a summer and weekend job back at another dairy we'd working on, which was a more registered high production dairy, and I called that home pretty much from there till 2008. With one short stint, I took a job in Eastern Maryland on a large organic dairy there. I was there 6.5 months and did not need to stay there any longer, and then came back to the home dairy there where I'd been 2019, excuse me, 2009. That's not right either. Good Lord. You might want to edit that parts out, but
No
I was
worries.
there for several years. I have to get my dates right in just a minute. I'm sorry.
No
Yeah.
problem. Okay.
It had
But you.
been 99 to 2008. I'm sorry. I was a decade
Okay.
in front. Yeah.
So you worked on this, you worked on a dairy from 99 until 2008.
Yeah, with a short stint of being away. I was in college during that time as well, but I was through that dairy. I was only not working at that dairy and in college for 6 months. And that
Wow.
was while I was in the Eastern Shore of Maryland.
Okay. And then from there, you got
From
into trying to farm yourself or?
2008, I took a job, another dairy job, management job. Again, that's the role I was already in. But some people we met, good Christian folks, and they were looking for someone to transition the farm to a younger generation. And I went there with that in mind. And after being there, we learned quickly that the transition was not happening yet and was not actually even in place and barely even in conversation. And what I actually, the Lord taught me there was, is he put me around two men who were very impactful in my life to help get me ready to be married. Had I not met those two gentlemen, nothing to do with my wife. It's just marriage would have been a lot harder for me without having to spend some time around them and understand some very important things. So I was
Interesting.
always at that job, and my employer would come to me very frequently and say, "I'm sorry, I don't have anything more for you exciting to do. This is way below your skill set." I said, "Well, I appreciate you saying that. I said, we're here to learn something. We're just not sure what it is yet." And looking back, that was the thing. I was there to be prepped for the next phase of getting married.
Can you, and maybe this isn't something you want to get into, but can you go and expand a little more on that, what that means, what you learned from them that.
Because of my experiences probably growing up with my mother and things of that nature, I really didn't understand what being a godly husband was or what it meant or what was important. And so I wasn't around a lot of role models who
Sure.
were in that capability and realm. And these two gentlemen, father and son, their name were Claire Lee Cottrell and Tim Cottrell. And the father and I were like, I say it like butt and sandpaper. We did not get along the best for a couple of months.
Okay.
And then all of a sudden we clicked. And I'm telling you, I really enjoyed him. And I think he would say he enjoyed me. We learned to pick and jest with each other and do it in a proper way. But the son was gone for a week on vacation and we had to work together and we had the best time. But he spent a lot of time talking to me about your role as a husband, your biblical role as a husband, and Tim would as well. They were just good examples in terms of how they treated family, how they treated their wives, what their expectations were, but more importantly, what Christ's expectations were. And that was a really hard thing for me to grasp because it had never been in context like that for me before. And so that was probably a good thing there. The other thing is they had a program with our church called Men's Fraternity. I've got a friend of mine in Nebraska. He leads that some too. His name's Derek Schwanebeck, and it's just a great thing for men to go through, men and sons, and to teach them about authentic manhood, how it was biblically designed to be. And as another guy puts it, you don't need to be anybody else's boy or a good old boy. You need to be somebody's man. And I think we fail sometimes at doing that. It's a hard thing to stand up and be that person. I
Sure.
fail every day, but I do try.
That's cool. Funny how God puts you in places you need to be and teaches you things you maybe didn't know you needed to learn. So that's pretty cool. And how long were you there? I'm sure it's probably a little maybe frustrating if you came with an expectation of being able to take over a farm, and it sounds like that wasn't kind of the case.
It was frustrating when you learned right up front that that conversation was not as far in as kind of maybe I would say led to believe. But I've come to realize that a lot of times when we led to believe something, there's just a communication issue, and I'm part of that problem. But it
Sure.
was frustrating up front, but it actually freed mental space to begin working on the next thing. I mean, I didn't cheat or I didn't steal any time from them, but in the evenings I would spend a tremendous amount of time working on budgets and plans for the next thing, because my wife and I had got heavily involved, mostly because of me, in a registered animal business, and we'd lost our shirts doing that. It was fun, but that's all it was in a very expensive hobby, and I wasn't going to do that again. It was production only, and it had to be a lifestyle component. One of the gentlemen I mentioned earlier that aggravated me when I was at his place and got me thinking when I was there, and he listened to your podcast, so I'm going to say his name. His name is George. He knows I'm going to talk about him anyway. And we were at his place in small dairy doing really cool things with grass, but he said they were recliner to recliner in 2 hours.
Wow.
And the dairy environment I was working in, you were 16 hours a day and you hustled
Yeah.
all day long to get her done. And if
Yep.
you have a good crew, or if someone showed up sick, Things just didn't get done.
Yeah.
And their chores were recliner to recliner in 2 hours. And I remember my ears going up, and we had lots of conversations about that. So our model was going to model that because, again, Tara mattered to me as well as we wanted to have a family, and that environment mattered to me as well. So then the next component of that was Tara and I were getting married and living in different parts of the state. So she took a job near where I was from, and I took a job 3 hours away because I don't remember the story. She could fill you in better. I'm not going to get this right, but for some reason, I remember that she'd applied for a job where this dairy position was, but didn't get it. And so I'd already committed. That may not be right. I'm sure she will fix that for me later, but that's how I remember it. So I guess it's my reality. And so we were married for an additional 6 months and still weren't living together. And so then the county agent that was a mutual friend called and said, "What's Aaron doing?" And he goes, "Well, I think I have found you guys a dairy to rent. And there's a couple back here where we're currently living. They had dairied their whole lives on their family farm, been in their family since 1798, and invited us to come down." And we started conversations, and it took us about a year to get a lease going. And then we started milking. We got the lease going, and then I resigned the job, and we started building a milking parlor. And we were milking. That was on January the 10th of 2010. And on March the 13th of 2010, we milked our first cow on our own.
So, a couple questions off that right off the bat. You said an extension agent connected you with this person. So, somehow I think people knew you were looking. Maybe talk a little bit about that, about how people you put yourself out there that people knew you were looking in. And the next thing I guess I want to ask about, so don't let me forget, but will be you said you leased the ground and you started building a parlor. And so, how do investing in infrastructure in something that you're leasing, was there some certainty of a long-term lease or some first right of refusal to purchase? I mean, yeah, how did you manage that risk of losing an investment into a milking parlor or something with a lease? But we'll start, I guess, with the first question of how did you put yourself out there that people knew you were looking and were willing to connect you with somebody when something came up?
I would love to tell you a wonderful answer to that, but it would be a lie. I can't tell you other than Tara worked with him because she was working as a soil and grassland tech here, and they would work on some projects together, so they would have some interaction. I knew Brian through school, but I did not know him really well like I do now, and it was kind of I guess through that. I have never been great with people, but in last 5 years, that's where I've spent most of my time of reading and learning is more people skills. Doesn't come easily to me. I like people. I'm an extrovert, but I tend to not do well with them. The second part, this comes back to a statement I made earlier. You ask about, if I understand your question correctly, how did I feel about building, or it was actually renovating, a parlor on leased ground? I felt like it was like this. This has got to happen. It's not going to be. I was speaking to my wife last night in bed that, like, if we're going down the road, and this is a cyclical story, and I'll try to come back to this, and we're going to stop and eat. There's 10 restaurants. I am not good at making a decision because I want everybody else in the car to be considered. But if we're in a tactical is not the right word, but in a situation where stakes are high, serious things are happening fast, man, I see clearly, and I often wonder, why are people not moving? Do they not see this? I don't and I fail at that sometimes, but like handling livestock, like when we're processing animals, there's the stockmanship component, but then there's the animal welfare component. Let's get them done and get them out of here. And I often get frustrated when people aren't seeing the situation, and that extra 30 seconds, and it's an extra 30 seconds that animal's got to be there, doesn't have to be. And I'm always looking up and trying to be in the middle about what can we do to make that better. But in terms of the now going back to linearly to answer your question about the parlor, or if I didn't complete that thought, I can make good, quick, clear decisions when we're playing ball. Let's go.
And
That's
things need
easy
to
for
be
me.
decided. You can do
Yeah.
it.
So if I didn't complete that thought, I apologize.
No, that's good.
In that particular thing, there was no There was no thing. It was like you burned the boats. You know what I mean? You're gonna make it work, as well as the, it was just like it was what I was gonna do. We were very blessed. They had a milk and parlor there, and they encouraged us to just use that. Well, we'd got a bid to update just to get it running. We'd got a bid, and then we ran across a guy from Iowa, also extension agent, good friend. Can't say enough about him. He became a consultant for us and helped us with numbers. Larry Tranel is his name, and so he has these conversion parlor designs. We built the conversion parlor for less money than just getting their equipment working. And not only so, it did a lot of things for people. So we could milk 2.5, 3 times as fast as we could have if we'd have just left the facility there. And it was new. I mean, we knew how to work on it all. It was made simple, plug and play. And as far as we were from a milking equipment dealer, those kind of things really became imperative. But yeah, it was the best thing I know is maybe you could call it ignorance. It just was not a concern to me. And we did have a longer term lease. We had to have that because of lending. We had a 10-year lease. And but that didn't enter into my thinking. That's what the lender needed. I was just like, we're going. Cows are coming, they're calving, you know.
Well,
Yeah.
that does help, and maybe it didn't come to your mind because it was already secured, this long-term lease. Like if you were on a year-to-year basis and talking about investing big dollars with the risk that you lose the farm in a year or 2 years or 3 years, that would stress me out. But that 10-year lease,
Well,
it's
I
important.
think it's important to understand clarity and context here, and I didn't outline any numbers. So like we are no longer dairying in that facility because we're on an evergreen 3-year lease because it's changed hands now from the father to the son. And so that was one of the reasons we are no longer milking cows. I couldn't make larger infrastructure purchases because of a shorter term. It does come into play. But when we started our, you know, the milking parlor, equipment, labor, everything, tanks, everything we needed was under $48,000. So most people will spend more than that on a pickup. So it wasn't like, and if you, I was a big person, a believer in return. It had to pay for itself, at least pay for itself in the first year. It didn't matter what it was, there was no deal. And when you look at the labor efficiency we created there, I mean, it was basically a 3x return in 1 year just on labor. So at that, my point was, is it didn't enter in the fact that it was only on a year lease. I would have done the same thing if it was just a year on that particular item.
That makes sense. No, that makes a lot of sense.
In other
So,
words, it was a harvester, no different than buying, you know, a combine or, you know, whatever.
No, that makes sense. And yeah, 48,000, it's a lot of money, but at the same time, if you compare getting into just about anything else, you're talking in agriculture, especially today, you're talking tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars, or depending on the scale, it could be in the millions. But that makes sense. And so you had talked about this guy who was rocking chair to rocking or recliner to recliner or whatever in 2 hours, and that was kind of the direction you wanted to go. What did you do, I guess, when you started? What was the model? You mentioned dairy, but what was your plan? How were you? What type of dairy was that
We
that you
were
started with?
seasonal grass-based, so we would calve everything in March. We dried everything off depending on production, milk flow, and price. The earliest we dried off was Halloween. The latest we dried off, I think, was January the 7th. And then we would literally walk the cows 3 miles down the road on a country road and place them on stockpile. And for 3 of 7 years, would then fly to the Keys for a 2-week vacation. Some of the happiest times of my life with my wife and kids because it was just, you know, and the cool thing about the seasonal dairy, just like any seasonal livestock operation, you could managerially focus on the task at hand. So it was calving for 60 days, and then it was, you know, getting them in peak milk, and then it was getting them bred, you know. So every task was, you could act like a large manager on a large dairy because all the tasks were same. Calves weaned at the same time. You know, you weren't doing those chores annually. And then, yeah, that worked beautifully. The first year was very tough. You know, I mentioned Larry. He was at our dinner table to analyze our first year, and he's like, I don't think you're gonna make it. And but again, that was the fire I needed because, like I said, okay,
Watch me.
you rubbed me the wrong way, big boy. And then when he retired with us, he said we had the steepest linear graph of any consulting client that he worked with. So he actually sat at our table and said, there's nothing I can do for you anymore. You need to find the next thing. But
Wow.
he, great guy, great relationship, and he really knew how to push me and do it competitively, but friendly.
That's worth a lot. That's the kind of person you need on your team. Can you talk about what that went from, how you went from being a guy who your consultant is saying, I don't know that you're going to make it, to the guy who says you had the one of the greatest turnarounds, I guess, and that I've met? How did that,
Well,
what were
we
the
also
things,
go
like the
ahead.
actual, like the logistical things? What did you have to change?
A couple of things you have to bear in mind that in any startup business, again, this comes back to the quote, it's not enough to itch for it, you got to scratch for it. I mean, what do you really expect your first year? So I think part of it's managing expectations. Second component was is we learned some things our first year, and things are going to go wrong. Like we're into sheep now. If you pick up a flock of sheep and move them, you're going to have fallout. You know, there's things that you don't think of that you're managing in your first year that happen, and you just got to roll with them and adapt and plan and go again. So there were things like that. We had never milked cows on fescue before, which was our year one thing. So we didn't hit our production targets. We knew what it was. We could adjust for it the next year, and we didn't have any trouble. So we had both a high rate of open cows first year, and we also had lower production. That was a blessing. We got to do a tremendous amount of environmental selection that first year because all those cows were culled. They're gone. And that was hard but fun. I mean, because then the next year, I mean, just the progress is so much faster when you're willing to rip Band-Aids off and move forward. And those kind of things really I enjoy tremendously, especially because I guess of my patience level, I like to see fast progress. It's the slow bar moving things that are difficult for me. In a book right now, it's great. It's called Who Not How. And they talk about that book that the first 80% of a project is easy. It's the 80 to 90 becomes more difficult, and then the 90 to 100 is almost very few people can pull that off. And it makes me think of that. I like the fast, easy, but the last 20%, you got to really have the resolve to kick that through. But we also ran across a guy. He was a retired professor of applied economics, I think, or ag economics, I'm sorry, Virginia Tech, Dr. David Cole. If you haven't heard him speak, travel to wherever you can hear him speak. But he talked about life cycle of businesses that first year, and basically until year three, you're sucking air. And so the first year, you're living on enthusiasm. Everything's new and exciting. The second year, you can carry some momentum from the enthusiasm, not from your financials. And the third year, be very careful. A lot of people really will pull the plug there. Because if you think about it from the life cycle, if you had calves born year one, they're not going to fresh until year three. From a borrowing cycle, your lender's probably not going to give you any more money because you don't have anything new and changing yet until year three. So that second and third year become very difficult. And we were able to get through there with good lending, some planning, some good things that happened, and making adjustments really, really quickly. And again, I won't overlook good mentors like the two men I mentioned before, George and Phil, are really helpful in those situations as well.
That's awesome. Man, I could go down a whole rabbit trail on dairy, but you're not in dairy anymore, and I want to get more into that and have time for depth on that. So I guess maybe if you want to kind of skim through the remainder of your dairy story to where, when you decided and why you decided to leave that enterprise.
I will give you what I call the ticker through dairy. In 2014, we had a bad botulism accident and we lost 34 cows in a couple of weeks. At that point, my wife said, "We're going organic. We're not going to do spray crops anymore." And I said, "Okay." So 2015, we 2015, 2016, it was 2015. We started shipping organically, and we did that through the end of our career there. The dairy had doubled in size. Whether it be farm-wise, herd-wise, that kind of thing, 3 times in 10 years. Well, the third time was in 2017. We bought another tract of farm, and we were getting ready to open a second dairy. We had a team member here, and he expressed interest, so we had bought another farm and a second dairy, and they would be to be twins because they were the size the same way. And we had enough support land to grow feed and grow heifers, and we were going to open that up. and we were getting ready to put in a big, well, an expensive rotary parlor. I had the lending done for that, everything like that, and then the labor situation kind of fell apart. We were building that too heavily on the other person, and we interviewed a couple managers. One was even coming from Europe. The day he's on the plane to be here, he calls and says he's not coming. So it was
Yikes.
heartbreak. I talked about this before. I think there's a literal Y in a cow path we have that a landlord had, but there's only one gate. It's either open or shut. So it's, and I've never understood why, and I've never changed it, and I don't know why I've never changed it.
Sure.
I think just out of respect, but it's like there's got to be a reason, and I'm gonna figure out what it was. But that day, I was sitting there on my knees crying when that guy called and said he wasn't coming. And so we had gone to ranching for profit at that point, and we were changing a bunch of things on the dairy. But I learned something. There was a book there called Extreme Ownership, and the team that we had the wrong leader. But also, I had the wrong team for the changes we were making. So the leader had to change. The leader needed to be fired, but I guess we obviously weren't going to fire him.
Yeah,
And
sure.
so the team then left, and yeah, it was rough, but it was actually the best thing that could happen because I had the wrong team. I didn't have the right people in the right seat and on the right
Yeah,
bus. A lot
sure.
of that was leadership, but a lot of it was we were making changes from an aggressive growth standpoint into organic crops, organic dairy, and doing things well on milking year round, till we wanted to go back to simple like it was before. We wanted our life simple again because all that had changed very quickly. And so we were leaving the dairy business because of labor and lifestyle. The third factor that came into there again was we were going from a 10-year lease to a revolving three. So we didn't want to invest in infrastructure any further.
Sure.
And then the fourth component that came into play was just fatigue. My wife and I, our last 6 months of dairying, milked 180 cows, had 100 acres of row crops, 250 custom grazing cattle, and 500 sheep.
Wow.
And I don't remember much of that other than once we sold the cows, she had to wake me up from January till May because I would just continue to sleep. I didn't know I was that tired.
Yeah, wow. Well, I bet that's wild.
Good times.
Was it all that you had thought it would be when you dreamed of being a farmer someday at that time? When you or were you feeling a little burned out?
I was starting to affect people around me. I probably wasn't as aware of it as I should have been, if I'm being completely honest. And that's what broke my heart. I would have gone through the suck longer until something had changed, but I was starting to affect people around me, and that was breaking my heart.
Well, that's good awareness. Okay. So then you decided to get out of dairy for all the reasons mentioned. Makes sense. How did you make the shift? What did you think would be the route that you would go, and what did you end up doing? And yeah, talk about that.
I'm laughing because if my wife was here, she said Aaron just doesn't do anything sensibly.
I
We
gather
went.
that they can listen, folks can go and listen to the Working Cows podcast he did with you. And I think she maybe does say something along those lines. So,
Yeah, it's ironic. I can't swim, but I like to learn things by immersion. We bought our first taste of sheep. We went away to ranching for profit school. My children and my in-laws lambed all those while we were gone. And I was like, well, this is too easy. So I doubled that again. And then I realized that we still haven't maxed out our land base at our home site and or my wife's labor hours that she was able to contribute. So we doubled it again. So I promised her the first year, I may have my math wrong there, but essentially we went from 50 to 500 in the first year.
Really?
And she kept saying,
Wow.
you said 50, you said 50.
That's a lot.
Yeah, well, it seemed like a lot, but and I do need to qualify that was a fiscal year. The calendar year was 50,
Sure.
but the fiscal year when we started with them until 1 year after that was 500.
Okay.
But
So
yeah.
a lot of things in grazing-based agriculture and cows, we talk about it's not that much work to go from 50 cows to 500 cows in terms of you're moving one group just like you would be before, a little more cows to calve, a little more whatever. Was that true in sheep, or was there a big shift in lifestyle and labor going from 50 to 500?
It's some of both. From if we're strictly talking grass management, labor management, I think 800 to 1,000 is just as easy to manage as 500, as 250. In sheep, and I'd love to hear feedback if someone has something different to say. There's what I call a farm flock. So a farm flock, depending on where you live, is different. Here it's like 100 and less. 100 and less is not difficult, and but it you manage them differently. You tend to manage them differently. You may involve barn and shed space. You may supplement them, things of that nature. But when you take that farm flock to make it a grazing flock, that doesn't go swimmingly as most people think it would. It's a different mentality. It's a different kind of environmentally adapted sheep to do that. And even the way they behave, there's a different behavior that comes from a small farm flock to a large flock that like we manage now. And again, I am not an expert on that, and I'm learning every day. And I tend to talk more about my failures than you're posing this more in a positive thing. But as an example, our first big lambing spring, we lambed out in that group. We'd split them, and in that first group, we had lambed 250. Excuse me, I'm wrong. There were 500 ewes in that group, and we lambed them out on pasture. Had a beautiful stockpile. We had 8 inches of rain in a 24-inch or in a 24-hour period. We lost 250 of our lambs and 40 some ewes. So when Tara says, like, he doesn't do things intelligently, he just jumps in. But I can tell you, I've never made that mistake again, But the thing that, again, because I'm not as adept at people as I wish I were, that had an emotional effect on my children and my wife and even my in-laws, because they were around to see the carnage, is probably the best word I know how, of carrying off death. And my hat's off to people that work in the animal harvesting business industry, because doing that every day, there has to be an effect. We went through it through a week, and there was a an effect that is still vivid and clear to them at this point. I can remember it. I remember it well, and I learned the lesson, but I don't remember it in the detail that they do.
No, that's an interesting point. I know we had one really bad bloat day with cattle, and that sticks with me too. That was 7 years ago or something like that. No, those are memorable experiences. So,
Absolutely. They're
yeah.
life-changing.
Yeah.
Or they should be.
Absolutely. So you scaled up in the sheep big. Were you thinking that that was the route? This is what's going to replace the dairy income. This is going to be our future at that point. Or you did this while you were still dairying? Did you know you were going to get out of dairy? Or
Yeah, the cows shut down in that same season that we were lambing all those ewes. So, they concluded in January, then the other group sold in April, and we were lambing there in March. So that was right in between there. Yeah, sheep were the way forward. This was just like building a milking parlor. This is going to work. And again, I am not the most intelligent person. So as you can tell by the way I'm saying that, you don't consider options. You've got to fail forward and you got to go. I mean, and I mean, I hate saying it like that, because I promise you, I mean that with all humility in my gut. I don't mean that arrogantly at all, but I had to win. I mean, again, there's tons of people sitting here telling me this is never going to work. You're an idiot, and that's unacceptable. It's got to work. And there were tons of challenges, tons. And sheep, I will have to confess that sheep is probably the steepest learning curve of anything I've gone through in my career. That being said, my dairy career was prepped from I was 13 to 25 years old. I mean, it was an every day. And the Bible verse is train a child in the way he should go. I'm going to summarize and not quote any more than that. Training is an everyday thing. That verse is often is quoted as teach. Teach is a lesson. So I was trained to do the dairy, but I was teaching to do sheep. And so those are lessons you learn really hard. I remember there's a guy named Mike Wallace. He's a cool sheep guy. He was a great help in Nebraska. And my wife and I were on a date at Chick-fil-A. We pulled over and we were like, let's call this Mike guy and see what he's got to tell us. And he was being very kind and very soft and very, you could tell he just wanted to tell you something. And I gave him permission, as I normally do, just be blunt with me. I'm a blunt person. I prefer that. And he finally said, you're an idiot. What are you doing? And so he gave us three simple things to change. And he was like, oh, why didn't we do that before? Now sheep are fairly easy. And
Really?
yep.
Well, I gotta ask, what are those three things, if that's okay? Because that seems like a pretty big, if you went three things, went from being a lot of challenge and a massive learning curve to oh, sheep aren't too bad anymore. They have to be pretty valuable lessons.
Before we dive into those three tips that Aaron's about to give, which are absolutely fantastic, I wanted to take a moment to tell you about Barn to Door. Barn to Door is an all-in-one solution built for farmers to help manage all your direct sales, both online and in person. My wife and I have been using Barn to Door now for over 4 years, but when we first switched to using some sort of an online e-commerce platform, the one we chose gave us a ton of headaches. Every feature was an extra cost, and to get anybody on the phone for customer support took 45 minutes or more on hold. When we switched to Barn to Door, we were so happy with our experience. We love their subscription model, their point of sale system, everything we can get through one product, that being Barn to Door. It's been awesome. If you're interested in giving Barn to Door a trial, go to www.barntodoor.com/herdquitter, where you can learn more about our success. If you choose to sign up, you'll get access to a free academy session. That's a $99 value. Again, the website is www.barntodoor.com/herdquitter, and I'll have that link in the show notes.
Well, I hope I have these right, but these are the way I kind of recall them. Number one was don't lamb in March outside.
Sure.
Number two was, so I mentioned when they were on a big stockpile, but all that rain just made the stockpile gnarly, so we had to start feeding those ewes. He says you never want to feed frequently during lambing because they will leave lambs. That's why we were losing them. The mothers would leave them. They would get cold and
Sure.
lost and perish. And the third thing was, he says, don't interrupt them. Set stock lamb. He said, so we'll find a piece of forage that you can stick the mob on for X amount of days. And I think he used 3 weeks to a month, depending on your environment, because of moisture and things of that nature. And then leave them alone. He says, walk through them, you know, check on them in way of picking up deads and feed your guard dogs and leave them alone.
Sure.
And my other sheep mentor, that was his advice when we started too. He says, everybody wants to overmanage a sheep. He says, the hardest thing you're going to do in a sheep career is try to manage them. Just leave them alone. Leave them alone. And the more we can do that, the better off we are as a sheep flock.
Yeah. Okay. Huh. Those are three great tips. I'm glad I asked. So with this, I'm curious on the set stock lambing. Do you have a pasture big enough to have 500, 800, however many ewes you have, lamb
if
the
you
entire
lamb,
time? Or do you move
if
them
you
like
lamb at the right
occasionally?
time, that was
Sure.
context as well. So that's also going back to stock density. How tall is your forage when you're lambing? So if you turn out and your grass is only 6 inches, you're not going to keep sheep for very long.
Yeah.
So, you know, we at that time we were lambing May and into June. So forage then was, you know, waist to chest high.
Sure.
Which in my context is too tall. I have to back that up.
Yeah.
So, but also that was a learning experience, you know, what was in his environment. So I was looking for a prescription, not the principle. The principle is have enough forage that they can be out there for 21 to 30 days, set stock without having to move a bunch of lambs, because that's when you lose them, is moving them away.
Sure.
And we tried drift lambing. You know, some people are successful at that. And if you can do it, my hat's off to you. I'm not doing it again. It's just
Okay.
in my playbook that it didn't go well. And
yeah.
There wasn't a large enough reward to do that. Now, we do manage that pasture adaptively. We don't lamb the same pasture every year, but we do try to find enough forage and or split the flocks where they need to be to get them that way.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. And
or set out. The other thing you can do is set out enough feed for them where you're not going into
sure.
feed every day, you know?
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, that makes sense. I was going to push back a little bit on your statement of, you know, you're doing things in maybe the most not intelligent way, because that's probably, I mean, it's being humble. It's not a fully fair assessment, because I would imagine there was some intentionality to why sheep. I mean, I think I heard in the podcast you did with Clay, you ran some numbers and there was, it looked pretty promising, and maybe especially in comparison to cow calf or some other opportunities. Did you, I guess, do you want to talk about your analysis of sheep? What did they look like?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. And I apologize if I didn't, wasn't, yeah, I didn't hear that in your questioning or I didn't understand. I
No,
apologize.
I didn't ask it until now. So, yeah.
Okay. Perfect. So I didn't fail at listening this one
You
time.
haven't failed at anything yet, so at least not in this
Okay.
podcast. I can't speak to
When
you.
we came across the sheep idea in its infancy, we were organic row cropping. And I have another friend of mine who had read an article from a guy in one of the I states, Illinois, Iowa, somewhere, who was putting in sheep into corn that had already eared to control late season weeds. And we were growing organic corn. I was just jacked about it. And in sheep, manure is very similar in analysis to broiler litter, which we were buying to grow organic corn. So like this is a win-win. And I just couldn't let the sheep thing go because it intrigued me. So what I started doing was when we started looking at numbers on it, compared to a grazing dairy, conventional grazing dairy, low labor, that kind of thing. Once you took out the overheads of the things you needed to milk cows with, it was a very similar projected gross margin. And so that became attractive. You know, that was basically how do we replace dairy income without having to milk the cow? And so when I say overheads, land, labor, and machinery, okay? And make sure that it's clear that I'm counting, and you should count labor as an overhead. But so land, labor, machinery, that those things that we could either get rid of and sell that you didn't need for the dairy, and or when you fairly compensated yourself for the reduction in hours, it was very similar. The second thing was is sheep were portable. A dairy is not portable, so you know it opened up to different land tracts or things we might want to do. That actually was way down the list, so I shouldn't have called it second, but I'm just going through them as I factored. The main factor, aside to economics, was the people component. I have small children at the time, and so stockers were not going to be a fit because we worked together as a family. They just weren't going to be a fit. Cow calf, we could have done, but the numbers, we'd have been back to dairy labor and overheads to run enough cows to do it. Plus, we'd have had to rent another, we had 700 acres under control at that time, and we'd have had to rent another 300 to 500 to pull off enough cow calf to do the same income. And then once you adjust for those overheads, you were right back where you were. You might as well just kept milking cows because you were at so much labor now to take care of that land base in different locations geographically, because we're spread out. To do that much land, we would have to spread out 30 minutes to an hour drive in a circumference around where our home base is to come up with that much land. And we didn't want to do that. And so that's why we kind of X the cow calf. We still play in some stockers, but you know, as the kids are getting older, we're doing more and more of that stocker type thing. But it was a wasn't on the table when they were little.
Makes a lot of sense at that time to go the sheep route. I think I've had a lot of the same conversations and look at it a lot the same way. And actually, it's funny now that I think about it. My dad, when he quit, he had a grazing dairy until 2000. When he sold the grazing dairy, he went into sheep big, bought like 300 or 400 ewes, got kind of burned out and had some troubles with them, and got out of it a few years later. Probably he talks about it. The money was there. It was probably just a management, and he wasn't doing it right. If he could go back, he would do some things differently, and he thinks it would go a lot better. But yeah, the potential was huge with them, but you guys stuck with it. You worked through a lot of those challenges and have made it work, and it still is your primary enterprise too today, then, is the
It is
sheep.
still our primary enterprise, yes. And I will tell you, that was a hard thing because, you know, like in 23, it's the first year we've had sheep that they did not do well for us economically. And that's hard when it's your flagship enterprise. Now we are diversified in a couple of things because after the dairy, you know, we've agreed that we're not going to do one thing. You know, we don't have a plethora, like we try to have just two or three to catch that, but it was a difficult year for us in the sheep with some things that were going on, but they have been very good to us, especially with all the lessons we've had to learn and continue to learn from them. And I am not a good shepherd. We are learning all the time.
Is there anything else on the sheep specifically that's worth mentioning. And I don't even know all the questions to ask because I don't have sheep. So there's probably sheep people out there wanting to ask you some questions that I just don't know the answer, which ones to ask. But anything that you think is worth sharing before I move on a little
I
bit?
have a rule list on sheep. Like if you want that, I will get that to you. And if anyone asks, I'd be happy to share it. Like when we do or don't buy ewes in, depending on their geographic location, I think it's important to. I had a gentleman call me last week, very nice gentleman from Ohio, and you could tell when I picked up the phone that he was just exhausted, and he had some foot rot stuff going on. And so we talked about that and some things that, we could work on doing. But one of the biggest things I've learned is when you're going through something like that, get off the stinking farm. And so that was my recommendation. I said, get your wife, get your kids, go somewhere for a couple of days. And I said, I want a text back this afternoon about where you booked to go. I wasn't this blunt because I didn't know him well, but what I would normally say to someone I knew would be like, or don't call me again if you're not willing to do that. And I didn't say that, and I don't mean it like that harshly, but if I knew you well, that's what I would have said. But you would have had to understand that, yeah, I didn't mean it that harshly. But and he did. He texted me back that night. We booked XYZ. We're going to go for the weekend. And when he called me back the other day, there was a different guy I was talking to, and that was so exciting. And then I think I want to use the word I know. But it's anecdotal, so I'm going to use the word I think here. We are not nutritionally supplementing our sheep in this country like we should. There's a key couple components that we're missing, especially in hair sheep. And we have been working very hard on those. And once we've gotten those better, we have less and less trouble all the time. They become easier and easier and easier to manage from a health standpoint in that capacity. Those are the main things is keeping your sanity. I'll also always tell people when they come to buy sheep, if you're not willing to commit to 3 years of owning sheep, don't buy your first one. It's kind of like a marriage. If you really don't like her enough to marry her, then you should not court this. Just don't do it.
Good tip. And you brought something to my mind here of talking a question on the sheep before we move on is genetics, breed type. I think you mentioned hair sheep is the route you've gone there. What are you selecting for? How are you like there's obviously breeds, but how are you managing? What's your production? Is it kind of a low input? What supplement do you use? I guess talk a little bit about the type of genetics and how that fits your
We
context.
started with Katahdins. I think they're a good breed of sheep. They're, I think, the most popular breed of sheep in the United States. We were struggling with them from being good mothers. And what's funny is I get pushback on that all the time. They're like, they're great mothers. They'll take any lamb that's out there. I said, well, that's my point exactly. That doesn't make it a good mother. In other words, if she doesn't guard her lambs from somebody else taking her lambs and leaves her lambs to take somebody else's, that's not a good mother to me. That makes her maternal, but it does not make her a good mother. So that was the first thing. Again, that goes back to a Mike Wallace conversation. He said you need to breed you some easy care into those and or change over. He actually recommended breeding them. I'm a rip the Band-Aid off guy, so it was more of a liquidate them and get easy care for me and then start the cycle all over again. And he advised me not to do that, but that's what I did because I wanted the results quick. He said that if I have him quoted correctly, a easy care would typically lamb or wean 30% more on ewe lambs and 50 to 80% more on adults than the Katahdins. And that is exactly what they have done. So there are parent block that we're running there. You asked about selection, natural. We like the ones that live and don't have to do much too. And then if they're not in that capacity, they will be culled. I do not sell anything like that for breeding stock, and it infuriates me when people do that. So those are sent to cull or directly to kill. Things that we sell for breeding stock have been here, have bred and done well in our system and in our cycle. That's how we've managed those. We do have a small flock of wool sheep. We maintain those to make terminal sires off of that we also run on the hair sheep. It's a very small flock. Question whether we could do it, but when trying to buy rams before, We find that they're out of more of a high grain environment, a high performance environment. So when we turn them out into a pasture environment, there's a big melt, open cheap. And so it's kind of a trade-off we make to develop them in our environment to do that. So they're hard and ready to go breed. And we've seen great fruit from that. But we started with 80 of those and we're down to 45, I think, of that breed right now. And that's about the flock we want to run. We don't want any more than that. I really question if we need 40, but that's where we're at with the terminal sire program.
Interesting. Is there a reason you've chosen to develop your own instead of and have this separate herd and hassle of a separate herd as opposed to just buying in terminal genetics?
Two reasons. I can't say they're a hassle because they run with the hair sheet. The
Okay.
only time they're not is right now when we're lamb. Well, actually, and I can't even say that. We've never lambed them apart from the hair sheet.
Okay.
This year we did because we've had some really nasty weather. I have barn space for 40, and it just made an easy sort, you know. So they're in right now. That's the only
Sure.
time since we've had them they've ever done that.
Okay.
But yes, to answer your question, the reason we make them was because of a high percentage of fallout on the rams. I mean, liken it to bulls. You're going to buy bulls. You're getting ready to turn them out. They're on a high maintenance diet. You know, they're eating well. They look flashy. You get excited.
Yeah.
The 3 pounds a gain to 5 pounds a gain a day. You're just excited. You big EPDs. You turn them out, and then 2 weeks later, you have a thin bull running around, and you're lucky to get him back to the sale barn. That's what we were
Yeah.
having in rams.
Sure.
I mean, the
Okay.
first year, we had 50% of the rams fall out in 4.5 weeks, and so we because these rams were expensive. I mean, they're not a bull expensive, but very expensive, and we just could not continue to lose them. And since we've gone to making them on our own, we just don't have high fallout. And we can normally sell enough rams to pay the direct cost and overhead on that flock, that wool flock through the year, that it's really not a burden. It's different. You do have to give them sheared. That's the main thing.
That makes sense. Okay, cool. So I appreciate all that. That's fascinating. Cattle wise, you said you're still playing, or now maybe you're playing around a little more with cattle as the kids have gotten older, sell by stuff like that. Talk about that a little bit. What are you doing? What's that enterprise look like?
We run some custom grazers for other people, some in partnership and some for just daily or per poundage. But we also sell by, and the article you were talking about was an article I'd put in, I think, Profit Tips for Ranching Profit. It talked about our sell by lessons before we'd gone to school because we had to learn pretty hard before we could get to school.
Sure.
And I tried to take very good notes of my lessons and be a little more intelligent than I had been with the sheep. And so one of the comments I made in there was is there's money to be made in changing an animal or changing class, that weight gain is a commodity business. Everybody does the weight gain. And so we will make several turns in a year of different things we do. As an example, in the fall, I'm going to start it in the fall. We will normally liquidate cows and go to say, and by the way, I need to caveat that this is not a recipe or a prescription. I'm just detailing a cycle we have done in the past. And we don't look at repeating it. It's just that's what worked out, but it worked well. We would sell cows in the fall. These were cows that we'd put on to graze and fatten, just thin cull cows.
Sure.
And then we'd replace them with like a light heifer. So what we did effectively is then we reduced our stocking rate by one third by doing that. We would winter those heifers. And then in the spring, then when the grass curve is up, we would sell the heifers, have enough money to buy the thin cull cow again, and keep a couple $100 in your pocket.
Yeah.
And then I increased my stocking rate by 3 times by going to grass then. And then we would do 2 turns of those, maybe 3 turns of those cows during the summer. Most recently, we've bought shortbread cows and sold them as breads or pairs. Or we buy a lot of cutter bulls. Cut bulls and make them steers. And those are the things that we try to do to increase turnover, utilize extra grass, and fill in gaps there where we need to do. And I really, really enjoy that.
Do you? Okay.
Yep.
So that was because I went to Doug Ferguson's marketing school and stuff, and it kind of a realization that I took away from that is like The sell by marketing piece is really almost could be its own full-time job. Like you're a producer, you like grazing management, and Doug does it all somehow. He's always busy. But you could, I mean, almost should develop, set aside a whole full-time type person to really just manage inventory when you start doing this at scale. And I was like, I'm not sure that's the kind of job I want to do, constantly watching markets, constantly managing valuation. But it sounds like it's something that you enjoy.
I enjoy it. Now, context is important. I am not, and am not saying and do this to a level where Doug would be active daily. When we feed lambs, we're active in it weekly. So we do check, we will feed 1,500 to 2,000 lambs a year. And so we're trading those lambs out frequently, weekly. So 40, 45 weeks a year, we're active in that. Cattle are cyclical. We're looking for, there's times of the year that we've been lucky or poised to take a certain class of animal and work with those and trade them out to the next thing. A lot of it is grass management. We're basically hiring those cattle to do bush hogging for us rather than pay to bush hog. So we try to watch classes there very hard. I should clarify, I don't enjoy weight gain cattle. That's a commodity business. You can decide if you want to work at McDonald's or graze cattle. Now, if you get scale up enough and you're getting enough gains, that's one thing. But here, you really have to have control of those cattle 60 to 90 days ahead of the grazing season to have them ready to go and in control and in room and condition to really gain weight. The cattle we take late April through June just don't gain well for us. So that's the part I'm telling you I don't enjoy. And it's not mainly because it's not a win-win for us or the client. I mean, it's, and when you're not providing the win-win, just not fun.
No, that makes sense. Do you foresee this enterprise taking grass away from sheep over time, like scaling this enterprise? Do they compare pretty close on gross margins? And how do you see the future of your farm's enterprise allocation looking?
I'm probably going to oversimplify this for me, and maybe, and again, that sounds arrogant. If you strictly looked at it as a return on investment to your dog, let me stop there. Let's forget about animals as an inventory for a minute. Okay. So instead of seeing an animal out there, say you got a cow walking out there and she's worth $2,000 right now. If you could visually walk out and see a stack of $2,000 and not a cow. Okay. So if we referred to our inventory and thought of it strictly in that bundle as a bundle of money, when we do sell by or where we do sheep, the returns are very similar. Sometimes greater in the sell by in high years, sometimes greater in the sheep. So we don't see them. We still run a sell by enterprise through our sheep. You see, in the depreciation model, the bell curve of depreciation, we will watch what the values are doing. And when a class becomes overvalued, they're going to leave, or at least part of them will. And then we will buy back an undervalued class. So we run that even through the breeding herd because when I was exposed to the topic, we weren't doing it with livestock. We were doing it with, we had or overvalued money and undervalued gates, livestock panels, pickup trucks, and livestock trailers. So we would make those flips to generate cash to do livestock. And I think when you can see things strictly as overvalued or undervalued or in a pile of money, it's easier to apply that to, it doesn't matter. It could be VCRs, Pepsi Cola, whatever it is. And we've tried to move about it that way, looking at the inventory as a pile of dollars and which one is going to generate us the best return during this time period to fill in gaps. I hope I articulated that.
No, that's a really good way to articulate it. And I like it. I've talked with folks in the past, like Wally and John Haskell, and how we're managing so many different businesses. We have land investment businesses. We have cattle or livestock production businesses where we're managing living animals and we're focusing on grass and maximizing production. And then we have equity management businesses. And that's kind of what you're talking about there is, visualizing this equity management business is you're a bank, where's my best return? Or, investment banker, where's my return best generated with this asset that I have under my management? And is it cheap? Is it stockers? And so if I hear you right, or maybe I'm not, you're kind of willing to flux where the market tells you. Your inventory may shift over the next 5, 10 years, depending on, sheep are better now, stockers are better now, or do you see some sort of a static herd numbers there?
No, that's exactly right. That's one of the reasons. So sheep were very high, a year and a half, 2 years ago. We liquidated a pile of sheep, and our flock is as small as it's been since we started right now. We have some custom grazers in as well to make up some difference, but that's one of the reasons they were hard on us this year is we didn't have volume that we normally do. So that you had to spread your overheads further. In other words, your overheads go up exponentially as your volume decreases proportionally. So we fill in those gaps with cattle, that kind of thing, as we're in a building phase of sheep now. We have some breeding stock for sale that are good, and we do that to manage cash flow and inventory, but we're not selling as many as we were a couple of years ago. And yes, we are in a cattle buying phase in certain classes. In other classes, we will take them to graze, but we're probably not going to buy into that class very hard. And not because we don't like the return, it's because the return may take too long to come. I want money to turn over quicker than the commitment it may take to do a certain one thing or another.
No, I like that a lot. That makes a lot of sense. Last kind of question I have for you here before we start to wrap up is this land investment business. And I'm curious your perspective on land ownership. You talked about getting into it as leasing is how you got started. And that was the thing that allowed you to do what so many people think is impossible. But you also mentioned purchasing some land over the years. And I'm just kind of curious your perspective on land ownership. Where does that fall? Where should that fall in a person's career in farming? Early on or later on,
I will. This is a very, if my wife should be here for this conversation, because she and I are polar opposite on this conversation. So I want to try to do this as well as I can. Her family has done very well with land, and usually from buying very undervalued tracts in a municipal setting, and then letting those appreciate over 20, 30 years as town grew, and then sell them. And in particular, her father has done very well with that, and I'll have to shout him out. I made a comment earlier about I knew how to make money, but I didn't know how to manage it. He has spent a tremendous amount of time with me, teaching me that as a mentor and as a teacher. Now, looking back now, is because I guess he saw I was going to marry his daughter, and what was not going to happen to his daughter, or at least he hoped wasn't going to happen to his daughter. But I like to think it was the intention, because he also liked me as well. But he was very good and instrumental in that. He will also tell you that he lives near us now, not where they used to live, and he doesn't look at land the same here as he did there. So I see it this way. I am a rental guy. If there are good relationships and you are willing to work and build the relationships. And even in the last 10 years, where our relationship has gone from a landlord of a father to the son, what I used to spend would say, just as an example, an hour a month maintaining a relationship, I probably spend 8 to 12 hours a month maintaining a relationship now, because it's just different. And so I think you have to be prepared to do that and listen and look for some give and take, which is difficult, because if you're used to doing things a certain way, it's hard to change. We've bought two tracts of land. One of them we still have. The other one that I mentioned earlier, when we were doubling the dairy, we just sold that actually December the 20th of 2023. It had done well for us. It almost, I don't want to, it done very well for us time period we had it, and we wanted to increase working capital to flex our muscle on the livestock thing. So it was a good time, because we had a bad year in sheep tax wise. It was a good time to do it, to not be hit as hard on the taxes. We also had a very willing buyer. And it was just a blessing that we were able to execute that sale as quickly as we did, with the tax burden as less as it was, with a good buyer. And so that's how I feel about land. Now, I do need to say there is no family land in my heritage. So I cannot sit here and tell you that, how you should feel about it or somebody else
Sure.
should feel about it as a
Yeah.
legacy. But there is one thing that I continue to see that really burns my biscuits, and I keep thinking about this with my children. Often I see farms and ranches. My best friend's this way, and I'm not going to say his name. They see the farm as the legacy and the kids to return to the farm.
Yeah.
I'm trying to see my kids as the legacy, not the farm. And I am not educated in that arena to speak intelligently about it, and I'm failing every day. But I do think seriously that we often think there's too much value in the land from an emotional standpoint, because I see so many relationships that have been damaged in the last 15 to 20 years, as well as the children who did not return to the farm. And your guest that was on the other day, the gentleman from Georgia, he spoke about that very passionately, about it was not going to be divided up, a man XYZ. It was going to be divided up about the person or persons who were physically boots on the ground running it. And I think we have gotten too far into equal rather than fair and equitable.
No, I think that's an excellent perspective, and I appreciate you sharing that. That conversation around land and land ownership is it can be one some folks hold close to the vest or aren't willing to share, or people have different perspectives. So I appreciate you sharing that. Last kind of two questions I've got for you here then would be one is what resources would you recommend that people check out? And that can be anything from a class, a conference, a podcast, a book, whatever that's been valuable for you that you think people who want to maybe do what you've done should check out.
I really, I'll do my best here. I've been very blessed. I will first speak with mentors. We had an EL board. And you know who you are, man. You were all fantastic, and I miss you daily. But ranching for profit was a life-changing experience. I highly recommend you go to that if you're willing to learn. I used to say you should just go, but I've thought about that in a great deal. And I mean, no offense, but if you're not willing to learn and make some changes, don't go waste everybody else's time,
Yeah.
because they are there to learn and make changes.
Yeah.
I recommend sell by marketing schools. A couple books that I just love repeatedly will listen to and or read every year, along with other books we're reading. But Knowledge Rich Ranching is a tremendous book. There's the Thoughts and Advice from an Old Cattleman book that's just fabulous as well. I can't remember the author's name. He was a
Horton
Southern.
Hazard.
Yeah, thank you. I
Yeah, you
appreciate
bet.
that.
I need to get that one back. I lent it out to a friend like 3 years ago, and I've been wanting to read it again, but I haven't gotten the
Yeah,
book.
it's fabulous. Extreme Ownership is a book that we have on our list. Even my kids listen to that. It's just there's so much in there about if you really would be honest and reflect with yourself, and people around you about relationships, management, and employees, team members, however you want to look at it. I love podcasts. My favorite podcast ever was the Working Cows 100 with Burke Taggart. I learned more in that hour and change than about myself and shortages. Like he made the comment in there that I've not forgot. And if you ask me how I'm doing, 99% of the time I will say excellent. And that is not true at all. But it's not a lie either. He made the comment in there that he says we cannot be perfect, but he says we can strive to be excellent. So it's a mental game. If I answer the phone and tell someone, do you want to talk to me? I don't want to talk to you if you answer the phone that way.
Yeah.
But, and so there's no arrogance, man. It's just trying to restructure how we think and how we address and answer people. We're doing an educational thing right now too that I highly recommend. It is called Zone Ranching. It's done through ranching.fyi. There's a mind coach there. His name's Bob Palmer. I would say this in front of Bob, that when I first started the class, like, you are crazy. But if you look at the changes that have come from that, It's just fabulous. Yep. Highly recommend that as well.
Cool. That was Zone Ranching
Zone Ranching. Yep.
through ranching.fy.
Yeah.
That's yeah. Okay.
And
Cool.
if
I've not heard that one.
there's a whole list of books, but I can't, I'm sorry. I just can't recall
No, this
all those.
is
If someone wants them, just like the notes I have on the sheep lessons, please text me and I'll email you a list. Yep.
sure. Well, that's an excellent list already. And that kind of leads to my last question then, is how can people reach out if they want to get access to something you've shared or just learn more from you? Is there a website people can check you out at or something like that?
We have no website presence. My good friend Austin Troyer pointed out, and that is the to-do list item of 2024. We are on that aggressively right now. And but you can reach out to me by telephone. You have my number. How do you want to do that? I
Yeah,
mean,
it's up to you. If you want to share it on this, that's fine. Otherwise, if people reach out to me, I'll just pass it on with you if I get your permission. I
yeah,
some
just do it that
awesome.
way. Yep.
Cool.
And always he gives you my number, shoot me a text. And I will call you back or that kind of thing, because where I live, my service is very, very poor. But
Sure.
you would also be better served to talk to someone probably more intelligent than me. So,
Well, I think they've already learned a ton and they would benefit. Anyone would benefit from talking to you on the phone. I really appreciate you doing this, Aaron. This has been fantastic. So much value shared, and I know I've learned a lot, and I just really appreciate it. Thank you.
thanks for your time and your patience.
The Herd Quitter Podcast is brought to you by Faro Cattle Company, whose mission is to help ranchers put more fun and profit into their business. You can get more information on Faro Cattle Company at farocattle.com. And if you enjoy what you've heard on this podcast, be sure to subscribe and check us out on Facebook and Instagram at Herd Quitter Podcast or at herdquitterpodcast.com.